Peter.
Michael.
What do you know about Persuasion?
Yeah, finally, we are doing an episode about my favorite Calvin Klein fragrance.
So this one, I was about to say this one is a little different, but it's actually exactly the same. Dunking on people who are reactionary centrists. Mm-hmm. We are in a period of a lot of electoral discoursing, mm-hmm. and I don't want to participate in that because I don't think that's a good use of my time or anybody else's. However, I do want to talk about the ideology of reactionary centrism and the way that they are actually a bigger threat to Democrats losing elections than the left that they are always complaining about. Mm-hmm. So today we are going to talk about a newsletter that I have been obsessed with since its founding, mm-hmm. called Persuasion, which is the Substack of one Yasha Monk, a political scientist that we spoke about in our Identity Trap episode.
Persuasion.
Jesus Christ.
That's just setting up a running gag where throughout the episode I say, Persuasion.
Freakonomics. My friends still do that to me. So to say a little bit about Yasha Monk, I mean, obviously we talked about him a lot more in our mm-hmm. Identity Trap episode, but he is one of the, I don't know if he's like one of the authors or distributors, but he's very much involved in the efforts to produce the Harper's Letter in summer of 2020. Just on the back of the Harper's Letter, he founds Persuasion in July of 2020. Here, I'm going to send you a paragraph from his, like, this is from his, like, manifesto of, like, why are we founding Persuasion?
A core element of this project is a publishing platform explicitly devoted to debating, articulating, and defending the values of a free society, emulating what Reason, Jacobin, and the National Review have accomplished within their own ideological traditions. I hope to create a space in which philosophical liberals can ask hard questions and come up with compelling answers. This requires both a commitment to a set of shared aspirations and enough diversity of opinion to force us to think very hard about how we can make the world a better place. This is a space for people who are open to changing their minds, but not their fundamental values.
He's constantly congratulating himself for this thing of diversity of opinion, diversity of thought, right? And most of the manifesto spends a lot of time just like complaining about like the New York Times, how it's too woke and there aren't like challenging voices anymore. Uh-huh. But then of course, the first thing I did when I went to this website is like go to like our team, like our board, our staff. He says, our community includes Thomas Chatterton Williams, Garry Kasparov, David French, Emily Yaffe, and Francis Fukuyama.
Oh my God.
And then the board has Steven Pinker, Norm Ornstein, John Haidt.
What a list.
It's 20 people. There's one gay guy, two women, and three non-whites. And everyone else is like a middle-aged center-right white dude.
Oh my God. How do you have Garry Kasparov and Dear Prudence?
Again, I don't really mind, like, I'm sure the board of Jacobin is, like, mostly socialists. Like, right, it's fine. Right. Like, you have an ideology that you're proposing, right?
Yeah.
But, like, he is pitching this as, like, this is a place where you can be challenged ideologically. And there's this big diversity of thought. And you're going to hear things you can't hear anywhere else. And it's literally just 20 people with the exact same opinion on everything.
Yeah. Whenever they say diversity of thought, what they really are trying to express is that they believe that conservative thought is being suppressed in
exactly.
the mainstream media.
Yes.
And so that they have to come up with their own stupid little media outlets
yes.
to be conservative. And so that's why they all end up being conservative. It's not about diversity of thought within the publication. It's that they
right.
think that they are being ostracized and left out of the conversation, even though they dominate it.
Every major newspaper's op-ed page is
right.
populated almost exclusively by these people. So these are not opinions that you can't get anywhere else.
But also literally by these people.
Yeah. yeah.
These people are
yeah,
all
yeah, yeah.
major op-ed columnists, except
yeah.
for Garry Kasparov, who, of course, plays chess and then
yes.
writes the occasional
and also
op-ed.
Tweets. So the way that I put together this episode is, I mean, I've been obsessed with this newsletter for years now, and I check it constantly because it's such a great distillation of this ideology. And to me, why it is such like toxic sewage at the center of our politics. I genuinely think that when we look back on this period, we are going to identify this ideology as one of the reasons why our country was so vulnerable to fascism. Mm-hmm. So what I did to try to impose some sort of rigor on this is I went to their website, I organized their entire archive by like most popular articles, and I read or I opened tabs with the 100 most popular articles. And so I was trying to come up with a kind of typology of like, what does this contain? Like some sort of content analysis of like, what are reactionary centrists saying and doing? What is the core of this ideology? Mm-hmm. So the first category of articles that we're going to talk about are just like straightforward right-wing articles. Mm-hmm. I did not know about this before I read this article, but in 2021, there was like a little scandal in Britain, kind of in the wake of Me Too. There was this website set up where people could submit reports of harassment and abuse that they experience at their schools. So it's like basically teenage girls talking about like people groping them or people posting revenge porn, like all this awful shit that was happening at high schools and colleges in the UK. Uh-huh. And so in June of 2021, Persuasion publishes a piece called "Whatever Happened to Flirting?" By assuming that any approach is malign unless proven otherwise, we lose something potentially risky, but also potentially wonderful, by Zoe Strimple. She basically says like, well, looking back, like, you know, I went to one of these elite schools and I don't remember any harassment. I remember like I wanted boys to like me.
Yes.
And then she says this.
Today, anyone who owns up to the fact that the audacious flirt, the yearning look, and indeed the male gaze full stop can be a source of pleasure and reinforcement for many straight women runs the risk of sounding like an apologist for misogyny and rape culture. Rape culture in quotes, of course. But there are many women who aren't constantly harassed, who indeed feel too invisible to men. Perhaps not harassed enough. No, I've added that part.
Okay.
Women who are plain, overweight, older, disabled, or endowed with some other attribute that many men consider undesirable may struggle to find sexual attention at all. And yet women's libidos are, as in-depth studies have shown, omnivorous, and female sexual frustration is real. The nagging misery of women who struggle to find suitable men to date or have sex with is therefore also real. I'm sorry, what is this?
Yeah.
What is this argument even?
She's literally saying like, you know, women online are complaining about like catcalls, but some women never get catcalled.
Right.
And they want male attention. And so what you're essentially doing, what all this Me Too nonsense is doing, is it's discouraging men from paying sexual attention to women. And for some women, that sexual attention is very much welcome. So one more paragraph.
There was a moving piece in the New York Times in 2016 titled "Longing for the Male Gaze" by Jennifer Bartlett, who has cerebral palsy with some impairment to her gait and speech. Bartlett wrote that being looked at in a sexual way was alien to her. She had never been harassed in college or at work, and on the street and in bars, having attracted pity, anxiety, or avoidance, she would much prefer to be stared at with desire. Quote, "Am I blessed to be sexually invisible and given a reprieve from something that has troubled women for centuries? It certainly does not feel that way. I like it when men look at me," she concluded. "It feels empowering. Frankly, it makes me feel like I'm not being excluded."
She's doing a like Uno reverse thing where she's like, well, to protect the rights of disabled people, you actually do have to catcall women on the street.
I guess the idea is that a very small percentage of catcalls will be directed at women with cerebral palsy,
mm-hmm,
who might want it. And therefore, we must catcall everyone.
And so it's
maximize
fine.
Your catcalls. It is very weird to just like not acknowledge that certain types of flirtation and attention are different than others.
I know. Jesus Christ.
What the fuck is going on?
It's also a total misreading of this actual essay. So if you go to the essay, this woman with cerebral palsy talks about she has been harassed on the street and it feels bad.
Oh.
It sucked. And then she goes on to talk about like on dating sites, when she lists the fact that she has a disability on her profile, she like doesn't get any responses from men. She doesn't get any attention.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, like I would like more attention on dating sites where I have put myself out for dating and indicated to other people that I am open to dating. Is very different from I would like to be catcalled on the street.
I'm confused. Like, this woman wants positive attention but doesn't want negative attention?
Exactly.
Make up your mind.
Most catcalling to me, honestly, like from a distance, it feels like it's more to impress other dudes.
I know. I would imagine that it's like just a display of like social power of some kind, right?
Totally.
I can say this right now.
Yeah.
Right.
And also why it makes people feel uncomfortable.
But also the point is that it makes them uncomfortable.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. And so it's very weird to put all of this into catcalling and also to hang all of this on a website where people are submitting complaints about like having revenge porn posted about them or being groped at school or having like teachers make lewd comments about them and being like, well, catcalling is okay because of this disabled lady.
You have to be impressed though by the attempt.
Yeah.
Did you know that not catcalling is ableist?
Yeah, you're actually problematic.
Persuasion.
How many dick pics have you sent today, Peter? How much do you care about disabled people? Wow.
Like the vague implication that every opportunity to catcall that you pass up on is a little bit ableist. Because what if that is a disabled person who wants to be catcalled?
What if that person never gets told that their tits look amazing today?
just trying not to do ableism today, baby. You're looking good.
So, I mean, if you look, there's a lot of the stuff that is posted on this allegedly sort of like iconoclastic thinker, bold new ideas website are just like right-wing ideas. So there's an article called What is a Woman?
Oh, God.
I'm not even going to read the subhead of because it's too tedious. There's two different articles about family estrangement.
Oh, hell yeah.
So this is this bizarre thing that goes around the right that like it's a problem for society. Essentially that younger people who tend to be more liberal are cutting off their like right-wing parents.
Yeah.
There's one called America's Families Are Not Okay, Inside the Crisis of Parent-Child Estrangement. And then there's a whole podcast episode with a different person called Why More and More Children Are Cutting Off Their Parents. And in the course of this conversation, this guy says like, well, you know, roughly 10 to 20% of parents are estranged from their kids. He doesn't establish that this is any different than previous generations. Like, we don't actually know the numbers at previous times. So,
okay.
Like, I don't know. Is that the baseline? Is that higher than before? Lower than before? Who knows? And then without any evidence, he just starts saying that it's because of like therapists. Like, therapists are telling people to set boundaries. So he says, today's therapists are really the high priests that make these decisions about who to have or not have in your life.
Okay.
Is that true? I mean, I don't know.
Is it true? And also, is it bad? Like two very important questions you're going to need to address.
There's another in the other article. It has this like really weird thing where it's like some things that used to be classified as normal parenting are now classified as abuse. I'm like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, buddy.
Like, for people used to spank their kids and now they don't spank their kids anymore. That's just like societal advancement.
Can't even talk to your kids about the border every time you see them.
Exactly.
For hours on end anymore.
And then another like major category is just like literally just complaining about words. So there's one called When Everything is Eugenics, Nothing Is, which is just like people use the term eugenics. There's another one called The Problem with, quote, Decolonizing Global Health, just like people using that word. There's one called When Words Lose Their Meaning, The Latest Casualty in America's Culture War, The English Language. And that's complaining about people saying white supremacy.
Yeah. When words lose their meaning, the English language has died due to this.
Because when meanings change, something that has never happened in English before.
Persuasion.
There's one called The Problem with Systemic Racism. The term obscures rather than elucidates the mechanisms by which inequalities persist.
For a split second, I forgot we were talking about words. And I was like, the problem with systemic racism. That must be a long article.
I should also mention, I think this is actually like key to why websites like this and why this ideology is working and seems to be winning, is that peppered throughout, kind of one in every 10 articles are actually pretty good.
Okay.
So like he has a couple articles that are like Russia attacking Ukraine is like very bad, which like, yes, it is. There's one about how if we really want to solve cancel culture, we need to get rid of at-will employment.
Okay, yeah.
There's a bunch about like the rise of strongmen in Poland and Hungary. There's one called Why AI Will Never Rival Human Creativity. There's just enough to maintain its credibility as a kind of independent publication.
Now, where's Yasha on Biden's age?
We will get there, Peter.
Okay.
We will get there. I'm assiduously avoiding like discourse and punditry, but we will have to talk about Yasha's punditry.
I'm excited because obviously the true heterodox opinion is that Biden is not old enough, but no one's saying it.
He should quit now and then come back in 4 years and run again. Biden 2028. Yes.
I want to see fewer sentences. I want to hear more mouth noises.
We were also just talking about like how Eric Adams has this way of just finding like the weirdest issues to fixate on and like the weirdest mm-hmm. ways to put things. There's also an article in Persuasion that is called Say No to Police Profanity. More tightly enforced restrictions on officer profanity is a simple, profound way to improve race relations.
What?
It's by John McWhorter. And then I'm going to send you this. This is about George Floyd being murdered, like the video of George Floyd.
What first struck me was that Officer Thomas Lane, who approached Floyd sitting in his car, addressed him with profanity, specifically the word fuck, very freely. This is a problem endemic to the way cops in the United States speak to people they detain. It goes some way towards explaining what happened with Floyd, as well as countless other incidents, and it needs to be penalized.
Does it go a long way to explaining what happened with George Floyd?
I feel like our buddy might have the causation backwards there. But also, anything that penalizes cops, I'm down with.
For literally anything.
If we want to just fine cops in express violation of the First Amendment, I might add, for saying the word fuck, to me, that's funny.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry, but that we're talking about a video of a man being murdered, and McWhorter's like, oh my goodness, they are freely using the word fuck.
Yeah, what about the rudeness? What about the rudeness before the murder?
People talk about lawyer brain, but no one talks about linguist brain. And he's got it bad.
There's also the thing, I know we do this all the time, but we have to do this. There's also just a lot of like low stakes anecdotes that are the subject of entire articles. There's of course numerous articles about this thing, the Stanford protest of like a law school speaker or something.
Yeah, this is something that was like big in the law community for a hot minute. But at the same time, I couldn't tell you any details about it, really.
And I even for this, I was like, I'm not doing this. It's also, I want to contrast the anecdotes where Yasha is not interested in extra context with the anecdotes where he is interested in extra context. Mm-hmm. So are you familiar with the story of Nex Benedict?
That sounds so familiar, but I don't have any recall.
I need to give like the most omni trigger warning we've ever given on this show. This story has literally everything that they give trigger warnings for. It's like really awful.
This is like, is this a young trans girl or something?
Young trans boy, but yeah.
Boy, yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Nex Benedict is a 16-year-old trans kid in Oklahoma. The initial reporting said that he used they, them pronouns, but then there are later interviews with high school classmates that say that he preferred he, him pronouns. So that's what I'm going to use. In 2022, Oklahoma passed a bathroom bill saying that every kid has to use a bathroom that aligns with their birth certificate. Next, it seems, was bullied for being trans essentially as soon as he came out. It's like really, really negative. A lot of the teachers are transphobic. And on February 7th, he and a friend go into the girls' bathroom, which he has to use. And they're in there, and three older girls come in. And the three older girls are sort of talking shit about them in front of them. So apparently Nex laughed, and the girls were like, why do they laugh like that? Like, it's so stupid to laugh like that. And they're like a foot and a half away.
Uh-huh.
And so Nex kind of like snaps, and he had been bullied by these girls already. And he pulls out his water bottle, untwists the cap, and then pours his water bottle on one of the girls. Mm-hmm. And then the girls, kind of all three of them, get around him and start shoving him around, knock him to the ground, and his head hits the floor. And they sort of beat him up. Like they really like kind of jump him after that.
Mm-hmm.
Afterwards, the three girls leave. Eventually, Nex goes to the principal's office. The three girls are brought in. And the school says that because Nex, quote unquote, started it with the water bottle, Nex is going to be suspended for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Nex lives with his grandmother, Sue. She comes, picks him up from school, goes home. He's not feeling great. He basically just like listens to music and goes to bed. The next day, according to his grandmother, he kind of comes out of his bedroom and like his eyes are rolling back in his head. He's kind of dizzy. They call an ambulance. They get Nex to the hospital, and that is where Nex dies.
Right.
The initial, there's kind of like no real news coverage of this at first. There's like a couple very small items in like local news of like a kid died, but like that's about it.
Yeah.
Right? But then on February 20th, so about 2 weeks later, we have a story in the UK Independent that is an interview with Sue, with Nex Benedict's grandmother, where she talks about like the transphobic bullying and how he had this attack where he gets a head injury, and then the next day he dies. And mm-hmm. so the headline of the story is, Oklahoma banned trans students from bathrooms. Now, Nex Benedict is dead after a fight at school. And so this is like a huge deal, right? It's basically like a transphobic attack. There's not a whole lot of information available, but based on the information that we have, there is then after this independent story, a huge like outcry. Like there's a bunch of other media coverage, the New York Times covers it. Uh-huh. And effectively all of the coverage is along these same lines, right? There's a transphobic attack,
right.
There is a head injury, and then this poor kid dies basically as a result of the head injury, right? So it basically gets framed as this kid was effectively beaten to death.
Right,
we then
right.
get this, you know, a lot more pressure on the police department of the small town in Oklahoma where this is to release more information. So eventually we get like body cam footage of the interview with Nex in the hospital where he describes the attack. We get like documents that come out. We get screen grabs of text messages that Nex was sending the day before he died. And then on March 21st, so about 6 weeks after the initial attack, we then get the autopsy report from the Oklahoma authorities that rules the death a suicide. And so it turns out that Nex had in his system a shitload of Prozac and Benadryl. It wasn't actually the head injury.
Uh-huh.
April 15th, so a month later, Persuasion weighs in.
Oh boy.
Persuasion has an article called "The Importance of Getting the Full Picture. The reaction to Nex Benedict's tragic suicide ran ahead of the facts," by Kathy Young.
Kathy.
So here is the first paragraph of her article about all of this.
A child's death is always tragic. All the more so when, as in the recent case of Oklahoma teen Nex Benedict, it involves the suicide of a troubled 16-year-old. Extremely long pause. But...
Yeah.
But the Nex Benedict story, which gained national attention last month, also offers some troubling lessons about media bias, uncritical embrace of activist claims, and reliance on alternative facts. This time, not on the populist far right, but in the liberal and progressive mainstream.
This time, the lies were not on the far right, something we've never written about at Persuasion. The sort of thesis of the piece is, it is still unknown whether Nex Benedict was a victim of persistent bullying at school, let alone whether the alleged bullying was based on gender identity.
Okay.
So here is where Kathy is talking about like the body cam footage and like extra uh-huh. sort of the documents that came out during this like drip process after the initial reporting.
Okay.
So she's talking about the body cam footage of the interview Nex Benedict had in the hospital with a police officer.
The video upended the earlier narrative in several ways. It showed Nex Benedict with no visible signs of major bruising, injury, or impairment, contrary to claims that the beating had left bruises over the teen's face and eyes. While both Nex and Sue talked about earlier bullying, it seemed that the problem with the three girls had been very recent. Nex had first met them in an in-school suspension class. It also seemed unclear whether the bullying was related to gender identity. The girls had taunted Nex and friends, the teen said, because of the way we dress. Yes, dress style can be an aspect of gender nonconformity, but it remains unclear whether the taunting was related to this. In any case, no mention of gender identity was made in the interview. Lastly, Benedict's account of the confrontation, which lasted less than a minute, according to the subsequent police investigation, showed that the incident was not quite the unprovoked assault initial accounts had described.
And then she describes the water bottle thing.
This is basically the course that every, like, police killing runs
in the
media, where, like, initially, the story is characterized as, like,
right.
man shot in back.
Yeah.
And then there will be later reporting that inevitably clouds it to some degree. What ends up happening is that, like, a big chunk of the media dedicates their coverage to the clouding. Like, ooh, this wasn't, like, the perfect victim.
Right.
And therefore, we will talk about that for the remainder of this news cycle.
Right.
As opposed to talking about, like, how, for example, in this case, transgender identity might play into social dynamics such as regular bullying, right?
Exactly.
Something that might escalate regular conflict between students.
So the whole piece is just a series of bizarre distinctions that are not very meaningful.
Right.
Where she says, contrary to claims that the beating had left bruises over the teen's face and eyes. This is false. This is straightforwardly false. The body camera footage was a cop standing like at the other end of a hospital room. And like body cam footage is not in like 4K. So you can't really see that much. If you look at Nex's autopsy report, it lists all of his injuries. A 1/4-inch purple contusion is present lateral of the right eye. A laceration is present on the right cheek. A red abrasion is present on the left cheek. A faint purple contusion is present medial of the right eye. Nex did have bruising around his face and eyes. Whether or not you can see it in the video, that's just true. So that's not a meaningful distinction.
Well, I'm sure persuasion issued a extensive correction.
She then has this fucking bizarre thing of like, well, Nex was teased for the way he dresses, but we don't know whether that was specifically transphobic bullying.
They hate Abercrombie.
Yeah, like that's, just a completely unrelated complaint.
Like, come on.
We also have text messages and accounts from friends of Nex saying he was teased for being trans fucking constantly.
Right, but what if you only reviewed the body cam footage and had no other context for this story that you are ostensibly reporting on? Then what would you think?
Also, keep in mind, the body camera footage is a 16-year-old trans kid speaking to a cop.
Right.
The fact that Nex does not bring up, hi, I'm a transgender child and I'm being bullied for being transgender. A lot of kids do not feel comfortable bringing that up with a cop who, in rural Oklahoma, might not be the most trans-affirming.
Right.
It doesn't mean that, like, it wasn't happening.
This is just such fucking, I want to call it lazy reporting, but, like, that...
No.
That
no.
Yeah, that implies a good faith, right?
Yeah.
This reporting doesn't even aspire to be more than lazy reporting.
Yeah.
It's so clear that the whole goal here is to be like, this is something we can ignore. Like,
totally.
This is not emblematic of any social ill that we need to be concerned about. Let's all move on. That's the project here. It's like, it's so surface level.
And also, even this fucking bullshit thing of, like, the altercation only lasted a minute. Well, okay, someone can knock your head against a floor in a minute.
I'm sorry, but, like, this is just someone who's never been in a fight.
Yeah.
A minute is a long-ass fight.
Yeah.
I'll tell you that.
And also, no one who was upset by this story was like, I'm upset by this because I think they fought for 3 minutes.
Right.
it's the duration of the fight that's upsetting to me. So then she goes on. Here, I'm just going to send you these.
Obviously, every single suicide, especially of a teenager, is a terrible thing, and a call for compassion is never out of place. But in Nex's case, there are plenty of other factors that could have contributed to the tragedy. The March 21st press release by the Tulsa County District Attorney mentioned the discovery of some brief notes written by Benedict which appear to be related to the suicide, and which, quote, do not make any reference to the earlier fight or difficulties at school.
So apparently Nex may or may not have mentioned trans-related bullying in his suicide note.
Mm-hmm.
We then get to this extra reason.
According to documents first reported at the Red State site, Benedict's father, Arkansas resident James Everett Hughes, pleaded guilty to sexual assault in the second degree in November 2019.
So after this happens, after this big media frenzy, the right-wing media goes nuts on this idea that Nex Benedict was actually abused by his father. And that's why he committed suicide.
Uh-huh.
They just found public documents indicating that his father is in jail for, it appears, molesting him.
Right.
What is fascinating to me, right, is that this entire article is framed around, like, the failures of the liberal media, right? And scolding, you know, Kathy's basically scolding the entire liberal media for, like, getting over its skis, right? And in doing so, she cites fucking Red State. Which is psychotic.
Yeah.
They have a million stories about this whole Nex Benedict thing where they misgender him, they dead name him, they blame Joe Biden for like putting out a statement that's like all Biden said was like bullying is wrong. Transphobic bullying, like we need to stop transphobic bullying. And then they blame Biden for like saying that bullying was the cause of death, which he didn't actually do.
Uh-huh.
One of their stories is headlined, "Why the Left Likely Won't Succeed in Creating a Trans Floyd."
Oh my God, dude.
The left
what the
is
fuck?
Trying to make Nex like George Floyd. It's fucking gross. I mean, like, this website is deranged. What the left-wing media did in this case was, like, they believed Nex's grandmother, who was like, yeah, he's experienced transphobic bullying for months, and then there was this transphobic attack, and now he's dead.
Yeah.
And so people printed that. So, like, that's the problem that they did. But then the right-wing website that's just straight-up fucking lying... constantly
right.
and like trying to debunk this whole thing and speculating on like the quote unquote real reason for the suicide is just like cited as a credible source.
The irony here is that she's making the same basic mistake, right? Like the mistake that she's accusing the media of, and there's certainly an element of truth here, is having a couple of independent facts and then weaving them together with a narrative that they couldn't verify at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet, basically what she's doing, she's taking all of the doubts that she has about this narrative, linking them all together, and basically saying, well, here is the correct narrative. But there is not enough information for that either.
Exactly.
The idea that this is that what happened here like exists outside of the context of transphobic bullying is just not something that there's enough evidence to say.
Also, she's doing something that we see a lot in things like the Twitter files, and there's like a weird news cycle of like debunking the claims about Kyle Rittenhouse after that whole thing too, where it's like they seize on the debunking more than they seize on the actual story. So if from day one we heard there's a trans kid in Oklahoma who was bullied for being trans for a long time, he had this awful altercation in the bathroom, and the next day he committed suicide.
Right.
That's really fucking bad.
Right.
And that does indicate that, like, yeah, transphobic bullying at school has real meaningful effects on people's lives. And we know the suicide rates of trans adults and kids is fucking sky high. So the fact that, like, oh, he didn't die from the head injury, he just killed himself the next day.
Right.
Does that mean transphobia doesn't exist? Either way, it's like, this is really fucking bad and illustrates the fact that there's a real problem, which people on the left are trying to address, and people at fucking Red State are saying doesn't exist.
I mean, I understand if you're just doing, like, media critique, which we do, then maybe it makes sense that you pick this, like, high-profile story to do your media critique. But if you are only ever doing media critiques of stories like this that try to highlight like transphobia, racism, etc., it makes me pretty fucking suspicious because, like, you know, we've talked about many different news stories where the coverage is god awful.
Yeah.
None of these people were writing stories about how like the organized retail crime panic didn't make any fucking sense.
Yeah.
But you could see it. It's easy to do that criticism, which I know because I have no training and I did it.
You read a PDF.
I read a PDF and then like Target had to apologize.
But really, I mean, one thing that was another pattern that I noticed in this is that, you know, they never do stories about just like this act of racism happened, whatever. But they will do stories about like discrimination against men and like discrimination against white people.
Mm-hmm.
Like they have this whole article that's like the era of men is over and about how like men have higher rates of loneliness and like men are less likely to graduate from college now. This, all these kind of structural factors that make it harder to be a man.
Yeah.
They'll never just print a straightforward story of like, here's what it's like. Here's why it's hard to be a trans person in America right now. I guess that's like too one-dimensional for them or too predictable for them. But they will publish a story. Here's why it's hard to be a man in America right now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you do care about structural disadvantage.
Persuasion.
And that's going to fucking get me every time.
Sorry, we just had a really long, sad, and tragic digression where I couldn't really do it. So
you've been sitting there, finger on the trigger. But that's the thing, though. It's like, and also, the people who are fighting for men's rights, like the activists who are fighting for men's rights, are also pretty odious, right? I mean, a lot of the people fighting for this stuff are like not acting in good faith.
Of course.
There's never an article criticizing those people, right? Yet there's article after article of like climate activists are doing it wrong. Social justice activists are doing it wrong. It's like, okay, well, on some issues, you talk about the issues on the merits. And on some issues, the only extent to which you're interested in them is how activists are fucking up.
There's a dynamic that carries over to a lot of like the reactionary centrists, but you see more often in like mainstream media where everyone seems to assume that a lot of right-wing actors are acting in bad faith. And so you just sort of write them off. You don't talk about it because it's just like it's meant to be understood.
Right.
But you have higher expectations of liberals. And so when liberals fuck up, you write about it, right?
Yeah.
But what that ends up looking like is a series of pieces criticizing liberals and zero criticizing conservatives.
Yeah.
Even though everyone agrees they're worse. They're worse at this. Like, if you go read a conservative news site right now, to say that it contains inaccuracies is to put it lightly. Like, go read Red State. It doesn't read like a news site. It's just psychotic.
I get the impulse to be like, well, I don't have any control over what essentially neo-Nazis are doing. They're not reading me. Whereas maybe leftists like climate activists are reading me. And so I have the ability to persuade people who are doing that. So that's what I'm going to write about. But then the problem is that then you get what we're looking at here, where it's like of 100 stories, 90 of them are shitting on the left.
Right.
You don't get the sense that like the threat, this very straightforward threat to America right now, the most urgent threat is to democracies, is the rise of the far right. You don't really get that because it's kind of taken for granted, or it's sort of tucked into a story like, well, obviously the far right is a bigger problem. Well, you're not really covering it like it's a bigger problem.
There's something I've heard people on the left say for many years, and it's that like liberal institutions will align with fascists when fascism starts to ascend.
Mm.
And I think that that's something that I understood intellectually more than I like understood in my heart.
Mm.
But now that we are like inches away from a Trump second term, and now that the far right across the world has grand designs that are sort of like within their grasp and to some degree, you can just see it very clearly and like understand. And it's infuriating to watch, but it's also this thing that I've known, I guess.
This transitions very well into the next article that I want to talk about, which is about, it is about climate campaigners. The headline of the article is "Cars Are Here to Stay. Real progress on climate change will require innovations that some on the left won't like." First of all, I just love that like there's no right-wing moral panic that they won't join. There's like the war on cars. Like, this is like the most fake bullshit, but like, okay.
I was just talking to Rhiannon, my 5'4 co-host who lives in Texas, and she told me that she hasn't been on a train in 8 years.
Yeah, that's most Americans, Peter.
The war on cars, my ass, dude.
I know, come fucking on. All right, so here's the first couple paragraphs.
"The climate movement, increasingly enamored of walkability and intra-city transit, has turned the car-centric lifestyle into a chief villain in the fight against global warming. And it makes some sense. Since the coal-to-gas shift over the last decade and the rise of wind and solar, transportation has overtaken the electric power sector as the leading source of carbon emission in the United States. Cars and trucks also belch out significant particulate pollution, sulfur and nitrous oxides, and volatile organic compounds, although mercifully, much less so than they used to. And of course, vehicle accidents are a leading source of early death in America, with almost 40,000 deaths and another 4 million injuries attributed to cars every year."
I love the paragraph where it's like, the activists are correct.
The climate movement is enamored. Like, you can't put it in, you can't make it seem like they're rational. You have to be they're enamored with these solutions to the problems that they're identifying. And let's be straight, they are correct.
So, of course, he's like, okay, they're correct. And then, next paragraph, Peter.
"Despite this, cars and sprawl remain extremely popular. Over 85% of Americans commute to work by car, overwhelmingly alone, compared to about 5% who use public transit and less than 1% who bike. Some have speculated or hoped that as the post-COVID rush to remote work takes hold, these patterns will shift. But while U.S. vehicle miles traveled plummeted in the early days of the pandemic, they have almost entirely normalized since then." So this seems to just be saying, like, well, they're saying, despite this, cars and sprawl remain extremely popular. Is that meant to be a counterargument against the climate activists? Because that seems to be sort of an explanation for why the activists are concerned.
Thank you for getting there before I could, Peter. This is like, he's basically casting this as like harsh truths, right? Like, this is something no one in the climate movement wants to admit. Like, yes, cars are straightforwardly bad, but a lot of people drive in America.
Right. That's literally the fundamental problem.
I've been to like urbanist happy hours in Seattle, and within like 30 seconds, people are like, yeah, America's way too car dependent. This is the thing that people are trying to solve. That's not a harsh truth.
That is the problem.
That's what they're fucking doing on nights and weekends.
I mean, that's literally what all policy reform like, is predicated on. Like, there's this thing that we want to change.
And then he then has this whole, this kind of fake social justice thing where he's like, well, low-income people oftentimes live in like suburbs and exurbs where there's not public transit service. And so it's much easier to get to work with a car than with public transit.
Yeah, dude. That's why we want to build
fucking public transit. It's like,
fucking
yes,
schmuck.
Everyone, that's the problem everyone is trying to solve. We all know that that's the case.
Also, the funniest part about this is that when you go to places that have sufficient public transit, or at least more public transit, way more low-income people use it.
He's even wrong, even in, like, cities without great public transit. Like, if you look at the average incomes of people who use public transit and the average incomes of people who drive, drivers are more wealthy. It's obvious, right?
Of course, dude. Cars are expensive.
Cars cost money. So, like, people who bike and people who take public transit typically have lower incomes on average. So he's just straightforwardly wrong about this. And also, like, this is not a harsh truth that, like, we need to build better public transit systems that go to the suburbs. Mm-hmm. This is sort of the, like, the crescendo of, like, well, what should we do instead, right? After we've accepted all these harsh truths, what should we do?
Catapults that launch low-income people across town.
The trebuchet plan.
While electric vehicles obviously do not eliminate the car-centric lifestyle, they are unequivocally a solution to both the carbon emissions generated by the transportation sector and the conventional pollutants like noxious oxides and particulate matter. And despite skepticism from urbanists, automation of traffic enforcement and partial or full automation of vehicles can help reduce traffic accidents and vehicle deaths.
So this is, again, straightforwardly false. He says, like, electric vehicles, like, don't completely eliminate car-centric lifestyles, but they do reduce particulate matter, which is not true because a lot of the particulate matter comes from tires. And electric vehicles also have tires.
Sorry, but if you watch the Tesla Investors Conference, there will be flying cars within 6 months.
And he's like, despite skepticism from urbanists, automation of traffic enforcement and partial or full automation of vehicles. Mm-hmm. The reason why people are skeptical of that is because it doesn't exist. And they've been saying that it's 5 years away for 30 years now.
Right.
So the skepticism is extremely warranted for, like, this self-driving car Minority Report future.
The lengths that these people will go to avoid basic infrastructure investment that every country on Earth has.
Yeah.
Like, good Lord. Dude, I was just watching the original Mission Impossible, an extremely dated movie, by the way, where everything just reeks of the 90s.
I love it.
But there are scenes when they're in Europe on a train. And if that train were in America right now, it would be the most advanced train in the country.
Shit. Exactly. So anyway, so this entire article is just completely wrong and bizarre. None of these are harsh truths. But what's interesting about this is that we finally get to the sort of about the author at the end of the article. And it says, Alex Trembath is deputy director for the Breakthrough Institute, an environmental research center in Oakland, California. Peter, are you familiar with the Breakthrough Institute?
No.
This is the think tank that was founded in 2007 by Michael Schellenberger.
Oh, that's why it sounded familiar. I was like, you gotta love it. You know what I mean?
Perfect.
This is a very, very narrow slice of the guy community. Mm. There's a type of guy who's an environmentalist, but that's their number two personality trait. The number one personality trait is obnoxious contrarian.
Yeah.
And so they want to help the environment, but as environmentalism gets more popular and climate change becomes more of a concern, there need to be an obnoxious contrarian overwhelms the desire to see the environmental problem solved. And so they're like, okay, how can I embrace environmental solutions while still annoying all of my colleagues?
And the Breakthrough Institute, the entire founding principle of it is the idea that technology will solve climate change.
Right.
They call it eco-modernism, and they have this whole manifesto about how, you know, again, harsh truths, the environmental movement has gone down this wrong pathway toward, like, social justice bullshit, and what we really need to do is come back to these technologies for solving climate change. In the same way, at the end of this article, he's relying on electric vehicles, right? He's like, stop doing all this bullshit, social engineering stuff. Let's just do EVs, right?
Yeah. Technology is when you have fancy cars. It's not when you have fancy trains.
Yeah. Or when you, like, build apartments for people. That doesn't count. Exactly.
No.
So I went to its website, which I spent, like, all day on. This is from it's now been 20 years since it's, like, eco-modernist manifesto or whatever, and it has this whole series, like, looking back on eco-modernism. And so this is one of, like, the main posts on the website. I want you to read this.
The environmental movement continues to embrace policies using substance-focused regulatory mechanisms and mandating preferred technology solutions. Carbon offers the best example. The 2007 Supreme Court ruling designating carbon dioxide as a pollutant opened the door to the EPA using that designation to introduce a slew of mandated technologies that reduce carbon emissions. Carbon dioxide, a natural molecule essential to plant and animal life and whose large fluxes are a feature of planetary functioning, could now be treated the same as mercury.
So this is like very straightforward climate denial.
Yeah.
You're basically saying like, well, carbon is like something essential to life and it changes throughout the history of the planet. And yet the EPA wants to regulate it.
Also, mercury occurs naturally.
The fluctuations in carbon dioxide levels on the planet have A, taken like 100,000 to like millions of years, and B, have resulted in the deaths of like 95% of all life on Earth. So the fact that carbon dioxide fluxes is not like useful to the current debate at all.
This is the equivalent, this is like the, on the left, if you can call it the left, there are like, you know, hippie types who are like, yeah, like I only smoke things that come from the ground. And it's like, that's not inherently dangerous. I don't know what to tell you. And then on the right, it's people who are like, I am willing to put my mouth over a car's exhaust pipe because carbon naturally fluxes over time.
You know, the history of this think tank is just like basically shitting on every single effort to address climate change.
Right.
In 2014, there's a big blow up when Nate Silver at 538 publishes an article by a Breakthrough Institute guy called Disasters Cost More Than Ever, But Not Because of Climate Change. And it's like, all right, there's more hurricanes and shit, but like, oh, it's actually not climate change. And then a bunch of scientists write a response that are like, no, this is fucking wrong. Michael Schellenberger, also in 2014, writes a New York Times op-ed about how Al Gore, his like Inconvenient Truth, was the wrong approach because it contributed to public backlash and division.
Hmm.
The documentary is correct. So like, yep, people got mad at correct things. I went to their like blog and they're like, they have like a monthly journal and like they have a fascinating blog post about ending the quote national parks monopoly.
Yes.
And they're like, it costs $400 to drive to Yosemite now.
Yeah, baby.
And then it's like, it's this outdated version of nature where it's like supposed to be preserved and pristine, but like nature is meant to be used.
No,
or
that's not
and
what nature like, is. Nature is when there's a parking lot.
I know. It's like, just say oil drilling, man. It's like way too chicken shit to say what it means. But like, we all know what you fucking mean, dude. Come on.
How is a live grizzly bear more natural than a dead one? You tell me that.
There's also, I went to the most recent issue of their journal. It's like the headlines are fucking genius. One of them is, do we have a moral obligation to abolish wilderness?
Fuck yeah.
The animal welfare case against wild spaces.
Oh, hell yeah. Should we nuke Yellowstone?
The moral case. The moral case.
the case for burning down the Saskatchewan wilderness. Dude, this is perfect for persuasion because these guys, their MO is like, climate change is real, but every solution that anyone's ever proposed is something that I hate. And that's what persuasion does with racism.
They're totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Racism, sexism, transphobia, these are all real problems. Unfortunately, every time someone tries to identify a solution, I get angry about it. And so here's my Substack.
Yeah.
You have to admire the sort of ideological alignment there. They've really found a niche.
Recall that in that article we just read on persuasion, he's like, don't do all the social engineering stuff with like housing and public transit and stuff. What we really want to do is EVs. Like electric vehicles are really the way of the future.
Mm-hmm.
In this look back at the eco-modernist manifesto, there's then an entire paragraph saying that government mandates to promote electric vehicles are unjust.
Okay.
So
never a solution.
Like, this is the whole thing. It's like, whatever you propose, they're like, no, not public transit. We need electric vehicles. You're like, okay, let's do electric vehicles. They're like, no. What we really need is public transit.
No, what we really need to do is trigger the Yellowstone volcano.
It's just like, whatever the thing is, you don't want the thing, and you're pointing to something that you will theoretically support in the future, but the support never comes.
Right.
Right? It's always, you support this hypothetical thing, but the minute it becomes real, you don't actually support it.
Right. This is like Elon Musk and like the Hyperloop and shit like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Everything, every solution that they propose is just a distraction so that you don't try to solve the problem.
Exactly.
They're like, wait, I have a better solution. It's just over the hill. Let's all go.
The other thing that I thought about all the time reading through all these articles is how this, you know, reactionary centrism doesn't really have any kind of values at its core. A lot of them are these procedural values about like open debate. We should be talking, you know, diversity of opinion. We shouldn't be shutting down speech, blah, blah, blah. It's all this kind of procedural stuff of like civility and things. But the problem is that if you don't have any kind of moral, like principled moral standards, you end up in bed with climate deniers.
Right.
Right. You become completely incapable of seeing a movement like this and just being like, nah, fuck off. It's climate deniers. Mm-hmm. Yasha should, like, any responsible person who like considers themselves dedicated to science and truth should have taken one look at this op-ed and gone, no, fuck no, we're not going to publish this.
Right.
It's obvious
right.
what you're doing. But you can't do that, right? Because you have to assume good faith. You have to take every single argument completely out of context. You can't look at the history of anybody's organization or the history of any of their speech. You have to look at every single piece in isolation and assume that everyone is operating in good faith. And unfortunately, people are not operating in good faith.
Right. A lot of these folks believe that this is heterodox thought because they exist within this sort of like relatively liberal bubble because they are like highly educated people. And guess what? Like Trump supporters don't really come from that demographic.
Yeah.
So they believe that these are like interesting heterodox thoughts. In reality, they're just really generic reactionary thoughts that they aren't encountering that much because they live in a bubble. And they believe that it's their duty to like to deliver the world from the bubble. But the world's not in the bubble. They're in the bubble. You know what I mean?
So we're going to circle back to Yasha to end with. We should mention in February of this year, he was accused of rape by a writer named Celeste Marcus. It appears that he was quote unquote dropped by The Atlantic, but he was never on staff there. He was just like a contractor, like a freelance writer. They haven't published anything by him ever since. He was like removed from the board of a German newspaper. But other than that, it was like barely even a one-day story. It was like there's this accusation. He denied it. And then everyone kind of moved on. And he continues to like make TV appearances. He continues to write. He continues to be employed by all of the places that he's employed.
He's one of those guys who's like fundamentally nameless. You know, there are so many of these guys that like we have come to know doing this podcast and just being like people who absorb this type of media. Mm-hmm. But like his persona is of no importance to the overall movement. There's 100 guys like this, which allows you to just sort of like melt back into the fabric of it and then and continue to work.
So just this week, he published, we're entering the Biden discourse, Peter. He published How America Got Into This Omni-Shambles, The Democrats Have For Too Long Prized Polite Lies Over Uncomfortable Truths.
I don't necessarily disagree with that subtitle, but why do I feel like it's about to be the dumbest manifestation of that point?
So speaking of which, Peter, he identifies three mistakes that the Democrats made. So here's mistake one.
First, during the primaries for the 2020 presidential elections, virtually all candidates and strategists made the giant error of believing that the loudest voices on Twitter were a good approximation of the mood among rank-and-file Democrats.
Can you imagine someone giving a shit what people say on Twitter? Anyway, go to persuasion.com, where you will find no one complaining about what people say on Twitter.
In the midst of the Great Awakening, talented politicians destroyed their own credibility by echoing the slogans and demands of a political fringe. They even managed to dress up perfectly sensible policies in the clothes of deeply unpopular ones. Cory Booker, for example, advocated an interesting plan for providing all Americans who turn 18 with some startup capital to go to college or start a small business. But though the policy would have been universal, benefiting Americans drawn from every racial group, he implausibly and off-puttingly sold it as a means toward racial equity.
This is a weird argument where it's like, I like the policy, but I don't like how Cory Booker talked about it. It's like, okay, so it's a policy you like.
Right.
I don't know. And also, Cory Booker also mentioned numerous times, like I went to his website, he also says this is a universal benefit and it would have universal, like it would help lots of people, but it would also help narrow the racial wealth gap. I don't know.
Right.
Like, I don't know, it just really seems like nitpicking at that point, but sure.
Yeah.
And then the second mistake that Biden made was choosing, well, there's no way for me to say this without sounding problematic, so just go ahead and read what Yasha says.
Second, with Biden's age already at issue in the 2020 campaign, his pick of running mate was always going to be especially consequential. But instead of assessing all possible contenders for their aptitude in the job and their appeal to voters, he successfully narrowed down the field to favor demographic categories. First, he pledged that he would pick a woman. Rather than giving him greater freedom to pick within that group, this only intensified pressure on him to pick a woman of color.
Of color, in quotes.
By the time his team was seriously vetting candidates, it was widely understood that he had ruled out anyone who wasn't black. So this is like, I mean, we're like verging into right-wing territory where it's just like she's a DEI hire or whatever.
I mean, literally, yeah.
Here's the thing, though. I don't mean to get too political science-y.
Ooh.
The Republican coalition, the conservative coalition, isn't like an ideological one. It's a reactionary coalition. It's political. It has strong demographic qualities, but it has a lot of ideological coherence that the Democratic coalition doesn't have. The Democratic coalition is the metaphorical big tent. It's a bunch of interest groups and demographics. And who's one of the most powerful demographics in terms of like their, you know, their willingness to turn out for the Democratic Party? Black women.
Yeah.
It's about politics. This is like, like Sarah Palin being chosen because she reflected a certain demographic. This is how politics works.
And also his whole thing is like putting the merits of the issue aside. Let's talk about the polling, right? They need to jettison trans people because like the public doesn't like it, right? But then here he plays dumb. And he's like, oh, she's unqualified.
Well, that's the thing. No one ever talks about, like, I use Sarah Palin as an example, but you could use Mike Pence as an example, right? Why did Trump pick Mike Pence? Because he was skeptical about his own appeal to evangelicals, right?
Yeah,
to, like,
exactly.
Religious evangelicals. Now, was he right to be skeptical? No. Turns out religious evangelicals love Donald Trump. But that was still the purpose. That is the purpose of basically every VP choice is like, I will supplement. I'm going to like do a little bit of ideological compensation and demographic compensation. And that's going to be my VP choice. You want to win over voters that you don't necessarily appeal to or that you're a little weak with. That's like, it's just politics. It's just basic politics.
It's also the reason Obama chose Biden.
Right.
Like if Kamala is a DEI hire, then Biden is also a fucking DEI hire.
Dude, they all are. Sarah Palin's a DEI hire. Like John McCain wanted to be like, I also, like my campaign is also for PTA lunatics. Like I represent you as well. This is such a stupid criticism. It's just that he gets upset when the demographic calculus operates in favor of black people.
Exactly.
Even like once in 20 fucking presidential cycles or whatever.
So mistake three that he identifies is like nobody was talking about Biden's age like before the debate made it really obvious.
Yeah.
Fine,
sure.
But fair enough. But what's amazing to me is that there is nothing that he will not blame on leftists.
Right.
Right. You have like a very establishment centrist candidate, right? The most centrist establishment candidate in the 2020 primary who wins and then goes on to win the election and now is ailing. And somehow it's the left's fault.
It's funny when people are sort of a little distanced from the left and don't really understand the dynamics between liberals and the left within the Democratic Party. Like you will hear people on the right talk about Biden like he represents the far left of the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Of course, anyone who understands his politics or even just followed the 2020 primaries knows that that was a fight between the left, represented by Bernie Sanders, and the center, represented by Joe Biden. To sort of blame the left for Biden is to just be unaware of the basic dynamics at play within the Democratic Party.
Well, here we go with the punditry stuff. So then,
hell yeah, let's go.
He talks about the fixes, like how should the Democrats fix this? So step one, basically push Biden out. Like he's like, you got to break
it
to him that like he can't handle it.
You have to tell
Secondly,
him.
Secondly, he says you got to get rid of, like you got to leapfrog Harris.
Of course.
He says Democrats must avoid the temptation of coronating Harris as Biden's successor. Unclear, like kind of how any of this would happen, but okay.
Biggest problem with these, without getting into too much punditry, I fucking hate how people are just like, what if we did this, 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 and this? And they're just describing like a series of incredibly complicated and like unlikely events.
Wait, Peter, wait till we get to the next paragraph. This is like exactly the perfect example of what you're saying. So here's step three.
Democrats need to think outside the box about how to give Americans a voice in picking Biden's substitute. If party rules make it impossible to run a formal primary contest at this late stage, the party should surely be capable of staging a one-day consultative vote in all 50 states. This would serve as a crucial testing ground for the national appeal of would-be candidates and provide the winner with some modicum of democratic legitimacy. Oh my God. This is like the risks inherent to this.
Insane.
First, you have to push Biden out, which is it's basically his choice.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to tell Kamala that we think you are so politically poisonous that we have to step over you, despite the fact that it's like extremely natural that you would take the reins. You have the inherent democratic legitimacy of being part of the incumbent administration, having technically been on the ticket during the primaries, not to mention popular with Black women, the core base of the Democratic Party. And then you need to have a aggressively contested primary that somehow like doesn't tear apart the party and cause all these fractures. The idea that you can just continuously introduce more and more variables.
I know.
And then Harris steps aside, right?
Yeah,
what? Like, what are we trying to do? Do a primary so that, like, Pete Buttigieg can go head-to-head with Gretchen Whitmer? Like, what are we doing here?
Exactly. And also, I hate this punditry fucking probability bullshit, but also I'm willing to stand on, like, whatever the fuck he's talking about, a one-day consultative vote in all 50 states. So a never-before-tried, completely bananas process.
Imagine the repercussions of ignoring that vote, by the way.
Exactly. Yes. And also the turnout for that would be abysmal, I assume, because like we already struggle to get people to turn out for real fucking elections that have real stakes. Getting people to turn out for a consultative vote is like, that's going to be tiny turnout, which is going to give it no fucking legitimacy. And then you have a candidate, like you're basically going to have this clown car fucking process. The entire time you're going to get the New York Times writing Dems in disarray, like these fucking weirdos can't even like stage a decent candidate, can't even give the reins to a VP that was chosen by the last president. You can't run on the fucking record of the administration at all, because you've essentially said one of them has dementia and the other one is completely fucking unqualified for her job. Republicans are going to be saying this the entire time. And then you have the outcome of a fucking vote that is non-binding. It's just like, okay, everybody loves whatever, Gretchen Whitmer or whoever, who will probably get like 15% of the vote and everybody else will get like 13% or some shit. So it won't even be clear. That's somehow going to be a lower risk strategy than either running the incumbent or running the VP. Really?
What if on the day of the consultative vote, it turns out that Joe Biden forgets that he agreed to all of this? If you look at all of this and think anything other than, holy shit, this is complicated and scary, then I think that you are overconfident. You know what I mean?
Yeah, completely.
Anyone who expresses any confidence in any direction on this, I'm just prone to writing off.
I mean, maybe this is like a mean thing to end on, but like, I really, the core guiding principle of like this whole reactionary centrist thing, which is, I mean, it's like, I don't know, a third to a half of all journalists seem to have features of this ideology at some level. It's like the whole, all of American journalism is like completely fucking captured by this. Is like, what really strikes me over and over again is how fucking dumb it is.
Yeah.
You're supposed to be a political scientist. Your whole thing is like doing punditry, like, ooh, how will this play in Ohio, right? You don't want to look at any issues of the merits, right? You finally have this fucking blue sky to come up with your own plan. Okay, what is the lowest risk strategy for Democrats to run on? How do we solve this in the next 4 months? And you're like, oh yeah, we want this fucking Rube Goldberg unprecedented process,
right?
Some just to like get around like the black lady I don't like,
and not to mention like when people like Yasha, whose I don't know, commitment to the Democratic Party, shall we say, is in question in my mind. Who gives a shit what Yasha Monk thinks
totally.
The smartest path for the Democratic Party is if you spend your energy trying to appease the Yasha Monks of the world, I fucking guarantee you lose to Donald Trump in November.
The thing is, we're all doing all of this like bullshit infighting when I feel like my own commitment to disability rights means that I should be catcalling women on the street from now until November.
Look, obviously, if Trump wins, we will have to pivot right and we will become aggressively pro-catcalling as a podcast, aggressively anti-disability rights, LGBT rights, all
yes.
of it.
That is the podcast.
Yeah.
Just us going, what that mouth do to people who walk by? We'll record it outside.
If books could kill, the conclusion being they all can, we're burning them.